Hello and welcome to Revision Media, here with me, Paul Stevenson, live with you here on this Wednesday, the 14th of October, 2020. And the saga of 2020 continues. I will be live for the next hour. That is 8 p.m. till 9 p.m. here in the UK, 2 till 3 p.m. Central Time, and 3 till 4 Eastern Standard Time. Wherever you are around the world, you're very welcome here tonight with me. If you do want to call in, any comments, any questions, it's always great to hear from you. The number is 855-492-6049. That's 855-492-6049. And, you know, earlier this week, or maybe... Yeah, I suppose near the end of last week, I felt quite, I don't know, I suppose I just felt quite troubled in my core spirit with everything that's going on at the minute with this coronavirus, in quotes, as the problem. And those of you like my, you know, living in reality, let's say, for years now, maybe decades now, isn't as it's presented. Chief among them that our governments, the phony reality that's presented, that our governments are to be trusted largely, that are can be depended on, and that they have our best interests at heart. You know, and even the likes of us who do radio shows like this, where we've been talking about reality, about real truth, because that's all truth is reality. And you may as well have as much of it as can be obtained and attained, because it's just wiser and it's safer to live in reality. But as I say, even those of us who have been even doing radio shows like this and discussing conspiracies and the deep state, Jewish power, Zionism and its various tentacles and control over United States foreign policy and beyond, And all manner of truth and reality. Now, we may not always get it right, but we're at least in the reality ballpark. And I must say, even for the likes of myself, that we, you know, I've been discussing all these things for years. We've been talking about Agenda 21. We've been talking about, you know, this new world order, I suppose, if you want to call it that, or the new world order, or however you want to describe this global socialist encroaching threat. It has been something, I guess, in the last few days, which sort of has hit me on a deeper level than I was expecting in terms of just acknowledging that reality. Because when you do radio shows like this, and as I say, when you're living generally in reality and you're not the majority, you can do these shows, you can talk about this stuff, but largely, I suppose, apart from, you know, the day-to-day frustrations and sadness and exasperation with things like immigration and other aspects of the culture war, the far left, cultural Marxist, and all the stuff we've been dealing with. To some extent, life has still gone on relatively normal. Now, if you go back 20 years and compare, say, 2015 or 2018 to 95, 98, 2001, then there's a big difference. 9/11 changed things a lot in our freedoms, for example. airports became very oppressive and uncomfortable and unenjoyable places to be. But generally speaking, even, you know, comparing to 20 years ago, you know, freedoms have been perniciously eroded and then exponentially so. But this is the big one. This is huge, what they are doing with this coronavirus thing. Now, whether you're on the side that they picked up on it and they're using it, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste, or whether you're on the side that it was planned all along, I'm not going to necessarily get into that necessarily tonight. I know what side I lean on. I'm very cynical with this, and I don't think very much happened by accident. But either way, this is it. This is the stuff we've been talking about. This is the stuff that's been discussed now for, well, since the inception of the internet and the onset of alternative media. This is their move, the big move, to bring in this global socialist, or as Boris Johnson calls it, the green new industrial revolution, or the new green revolution, or however he described it. And it really did hit me over the last sort of week or so. And the sadness that comes with that, and the frustration, and I'll have to say, to some extent, the anxiety that comes with it. You know, this is no joke. These lockdowns and the measures that the governments have taken, not the coronavirus, which largely I like to call it the Wizard of Oz virus, because when you pull back that curtain, there's nothing to fear there. And even though I was doing videos on this and talking about this right from the start, like many of us who are informed are, this was not a big surprise to us that this was largely a hoax. Notwithstanding, you know, it's killing some people, but so does flu every year. It kills really old people and people with compromised immune systems. Apart from that, you could probably get more chance of being killed in a road traffic accident or, I don't know, a coconut falling on your head. But we've been calling this from the start. And this thing is such a smokescreen for the economic catastrophe that was in waiting anyway. And not the coronavirus, but the measures and the policies and the lack of opposition to them, particularly in this country anyway as well. And it's not dissimilar around the world. I don't think there's any hyperbole sufficient to describe the devastation, destruction this is doing societally, economically. Obviously, those two things are so linked. This isn't a choice between the health and the economy. In many ways, the economy is a societal organism, which, as part of it, health is an aspect of it. They're not two separate things. Poverty kills. And it's really unnerved me this week. And I suppose it sort of comes with the fact that we've had talk and the implementation of more lockdowns here in the UK. But it really did hit me this week. This is so serious. And it's almost like a feeling of claustrophobia, which I think is sufficient, or is... the word I'm looking for, an appropriate kind of a sense, because the governments are strangling us. The governments have gained so much power because of this that it's claustrophobic. They're out of control. They've got powers that they could only dream of a year ago. And it really does feel that we're just at their mercy now. They can do what they want, and they are doing what they want. There's very little pushback on it. One thing I will say, though, is that more and more people are becoming aware that something is really, really not right here. People, I suppose a lot of them would be your kind of centrist types, who would, to some extent, be relatively right wing. I suppose the Farages of this world and others like that sort of centrist type characters, who wouldn't really go there with the tinfoil hat conspiracy theorists. I say tinfoil hat sarcastically. I mean, there are people out there who, go crazy with certain conspiracies where it is just out there. But not on these shows, not on shows I do, not on shows on, or articles that I listen to or cover. This is just reality. And one of the encouraging things is that more and more people, in particular that sort of center left, centrist, sort of center right territory, are seeing that the data and the government's policies simply do not equate. And their conclusion is a correct one. Something is not right here. Even the governments, who they like to afford the benefit of the doubt of incompetence so incessantly, could not possibly be this stupid to get this so vastly wrong. And people are asking the singular most important question of all. And that is why? Why are they doing this? And that's the best question they can ask, because that smashes down the barriers in their minds, the bigotry, their worldviews, that governments have their best interests at heart, that the world is the way they were brought up to believe it is. That it's a good world. That we fought the good fight in World War II and we were the good guys. That we always fight the good wars. We have caring governments. Yes, they make mistakes. And yes, of course, there's a few rogues here and there, and there's bad eggs. And increasingly over the years, we've seen that they're so dedicated to this Marxist far left zeal. But still, we usually stop short of suspecting real nefarious motivations and hearts in those that govern and rule over us. And I think that's starting to crumble now, because those types of people now are asking the right question, why? And then they can start to explore reality properly. They can start looking at things like the World Economic Forum, Bill Gates, other large bureaucratic bodies, the IMF, the World Bank, the Federal Reserve, our own central bank. Maybe one day we might even get these people who would actually look at the impact of Jewish power and lobbying and go beyond just George Soros. But that's not a bad start if even people start looking in that direction a bit more. Because let's face it, the world is a darker place than these people want to acknowledge. Governments given half a chance will be despotic. These people are power hungry. The people that have bought and paid them are desperate for more control than anything else. So if minds can be open and conspiracies can be entertained, that is a good thing. And we might get closer to the truth. Because, as I said, all truth is reality. And reality is an objective phenomenon. We live in an age of reality, this idea of relativism. You have your truth, I have my truth. And there is no real truth. That's nonsense. Reality is an objective phenomena. It cares not about your relationship with it, whether you like it, whether you hate it, whether you're indifferent to it. It exists independently outside of your relationship with it. So you may as well live consistent with it, because it is a very painful way of crashing in and around those, and an inconvenient way of crashing in and around those who are not living consistent with it. And it's like that boxing analogy, isn't it? It's the punch you don't see that does the damage. Now, those of us who have been living in reality for some time now, we've seen this coming. We've been talking about it. We've been exposing about it. And even as I said at the start, when I opened the show, when it comes, it's still devastating to see the absolute destruction, the seismic, profound restructuring of society. To even call it social engineering, it doesn't capture and encapsulate what has happened in 2020 and what is currently happening as I speak in many of our nations, most of our nations. But even when it comes, it's a devastating blow. But if you're living in fairyland where you think that largely governments are, you know, decent guys for the most part, and they're not involved with any larger conspiracies, yeah, we probably say we don't like them and they're all in it for their own gain and everything else. But that's as far as it goes. They don't see this larger picture. They don't have a concept of history, of the larger bodies and families and connections of the very small amount of people who really call the shots in this construct. Notwithstanding, as a Christian, of course, that the Lord will only allow darkness to come when he thinks that a nation needs it. And perhaps, and I believe actually, that we have despised the Lord so much in the Western nations so much for so long now, that we have invited his wrath. And when it comes, it's not pretty. It's come in the form of immigration, in my opinion, and now it's come in the form of the restriction of our liberties to the extent that we're in this mess right now, being ruled over and having our lives dictated to by half a dozen people here in the UK, including the intolerable Matt Hancock, that little despotic piece of human garbage up in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, and the even more despotic, deplorable, uncharismatic, uncharming, inarticulate, but yet one of the arrogant scumbags I think I've ever had the misfortune to ever even have to listen to a sentence that he's ever said. Hubris of this guy, Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan, an immigrant into this country in the 70s. Like a lot of our ruling class now who, you know, Rishi Sunak, again, second generation immigrant. The irony of having Priti Patel as the Home Secretary. This country and its heritage and its culture and going into the future, it is of no concern to these people. It is not their culture. They have been here 5 minutes. And like I said, when the Lord lowers the boom, and I know some of you listening may not agree, and that's fine. It's not my job to convince you, but I see something supernatural in what's happening here to the Western nations, which have been so blessed and have had it so great for, and we've blew it. And we're in this state. But however it is, or whatever's brought it about, it's to call it disconcerting is the understatement. And it really did hit me, as I say, despite being aware of this, despite seeing the punches, but despite living in reality the week, it's just unnerved me, because you don't really know what's coming next and how bad it's going to get and how quickly. Now, if Stingy masks him in the summer, when the virus is at an all-time low and essentially it's passed in terms of its peak, then what hope is that these masks are ever going to be relinquished? You know, try getting your ball back when you give it over to the governments. They're not going to relinquish these powers, and they are obsessed with these lockdowns, which, for all intents and purposes, the data has shown to be largely ineffective. Despite even the first lockdown, that virus had peaked before the lockdowns could possibly have any effect. And yet we're still in lockdown. Northern Ireland today have brought in a full lockdown in Northern Ireland, apart from, you know, the retail sector and a few others. There's still a strong Christian presence in Northern Ireland, so I think they've been lobbied by the churches over there, so they've been pretty lenient on the churches too, comparatively anyway. But they're in a full lockdown. Keir Starmer, another moron with absolutely no charisma, no presence, has now been calling for a full 3-week circuit breaker. Where do they get these words from? Circuit breaker? What the hell is that? I mean, these people, it's almost funny. I mean, it's painful. Circuit breaker. We've had new restrictions over here, and this is despite the World Health Organization themselves, who are another one of these. Even they have come out and said, advised against lockdowns. Here they are. It was about 5 days ago, just before we brought in more lockdowns over here.
I want to say it again. We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as a primary means of control of this virus. The only time we believe a lockdown is justified is to buy you time to reorganize, regroup, rebalance your resources, protect your health workers who are exhausted. But at large, we'd rather not do it. This is a terrible, ghastly global catastrophe, actually. And so we really do appeal to all world leaders. Stop using lockdown as your primary control method. Remember, lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer.
And there we have it.
So that was the World Health Organization, and that was played in a clip. Actually, I'm going to try and get this guy on the show. That I'm going to play in a minute. Ivor Cummins. He's an Irish guy, actually. And the data. And I might just play that, because it's tremendous value. That it's, I mean, how long is it? Well, we've got enough time. It's half an hour. This is just so worth listening to. Check this guy out, Ivor Cummins. And his YouTube channel. Hopefully I can get him on. He's in high demand, so I don't know. And I don't know, I mean, from listening to him, he doesn't seem to be pulling any punches. He doesn't seem to be politically, too sensitive in terms of how he's viewed, in terms of how far he's prepared to go. I wouldn't be asking him to go any further than he's already on his own YouTube videos in terms of, you know, he's not holding back in terms of how big a hoax this is. Not by opinions or attitudes, because he doesn't trust governments or anything else. He doesn't seem to have a dog in the fight. He's just a data guy. And those guys are really of value. So I'll play this for a bit, because there's a guy called Ivor Cummins.
There we have it. So they finally have come around to agree with myself and all the professors and analysts all over the world that lockdowns are not the tool to control the virus, unless you are in an utterly overwhelmed situation. So we go on and we look at Ireland in last March, April, and I pulled this way back April 22nd. We had this news item the government.ie website, 44 new deaths on that day. Median age was 87, which was pretty typical, and most had underlying health conditions, and the remainder mostly were very aged. So that was in the news. On the same day, this was in the news. Nursing home staff told don't wear face masks unless there's a virus outbreak, by which time, of course, it will be way too late for the residents of the care home. So this is the kind of thing that was going on in Ireland during the epidemic itself. I also want to draw attention to this, which I sent out way back in May. And basically, nearly 60% of the people who actually passed, sadly, during the epidemic itself, were hospitalized. So they essentially died in their beds because the majority were care home inhabitants. I'll also draw your attention, just 80 people who died had been admitted to intensive care. And this is from RTE back in May. So to emphasize that, 95% of the people who passed were too aged or moribund or comorbid to even be afforded intensive care treatment. In other words, an ethical decision that they were so ill or aged that it was not appropriate to even try and save them, independent of SARS-CoV-2. So keep that in mind for perspective. So we look now at Ireland, and here is the epidemic where we had many sad passings of people. And then after that, around end of May, the epidemic was clearly gone. And this is right up to date. So the epidemic is long gone. But remember that 95% of the people who passed in the actual epidemic were too aged or moribund to even be given ICU. So we'll draw the trend line of what actually happened in deaths per million. And let's take out the 95% just for perspective. All lives are important, of course, but let's just look if we take out the 95% who are never even afforded an ICU. We see this. So during the peak, less than one person per million who's outside of that group, and obviously flatlined ever since if you remove these groups. Let's look at the actual impact on all-cause mortality in deaths per 1,000 population over the past years. And credit to Graham Neary, who's pulled this data from CSO. So we see the previous years pretty steady. Notably, 2019 in Ireland had a relatively low number of deaths per 1,000. So a lot of people who would have died otherwise in this soft season, if you will, would have been certainly in the line of fire, so to speak, when a new virus like SARS-CoV-2 came along. So we'd expect 2020 to have higher deaths per 1,000 in the January to May period compared to prior years, especially with 19 being low. So let's take a look and see. Very interesting. So in spite of a low mortality year prior, it didn't even...
Obviously, I appreciate that many of you, if you're listening, you can't see the charts here, but he's looking at 2015, 2016, 2017, 18, 2019 and 20. The information he's talking about, the charts look pretty much the same. In other words, there is no difference in this year, despite the coronavirus hysteria.
Exceed other years prior. So that's the reality of the Ireland epidemic. And again, to stress, this is January to May per 1,000 for all the years, right? A direct compare. And I'm guessing a lot of people watching this have no idea that this is the reality. Let's look at it with monthly. And again, January through to May for all the years. 2020, you probably realize now, is not going to stand out. In fact, we have red here for April, where most passings sadly occurred, but you'll notice that April, the worst month of the SARS-CoV-2 epidemic in Ireland, doesn't even exceed January of 17 and 18. And overall, if we took out the red and jumbled the years, there's no way you could pick out the epidemic year in Ireland, right? Let's look momentarily at Sweden, because one of the reasons we got into a crazy epidemic management hysteria was the modelling. So here is various versions of modelling in March that showed Sweden would have enormous deaths without doing full lockdown. And here in blue is what actually happened. If we look at Sweden and Ireland, they're not much different. Any increase had in deaths per million is fully accountable for by their care home density, by their Somali subpopulation in Stockholm, where they got hit pretty hard, and by multiple other factors, including their soft 19 season. So they're essentially the same as Ireland without any lockdown, because the modelling was out by a factor of 10 to 12, and that's established now. That was the main problem. In terms of lockdown, you have to be very clear if you're scientific. There are now multiple published papers that have done the analysis on the actual data, not the modelling, but the actual real world, and shown that lockdown adds little or nothing to the impacts. Other factors do, like population health and softness or hardness, flu seasons. So this is established. So if you want to be scientific, you can't go around saying lockdown is a big contributor to mitigating impacts. And at this URL, you will get all these studies and you can look at them. Actually, you don't need a lot of science. Basic logic kind of works too. So here's an article from way back in May or June, and Aldi, in spite of all their workers being not locked a day with no masks, mixing with all the great unwashed coming in and out all day long, they had no signal for infection or mortality. And that's even.
And that's a great point. Back at the time, you know, don't forget, we didn't bring masks in here until the 24th of July. But to that point, when, you know, when they brought in the first lockdown and everything else, there was people working in Tesco's and the big stores, people coming in and out all the time. They weren't wearing masks or anything. And there was no really huge spike, as if they were dropping like flies. And, you know, okay, well, you know, these people are almost like kamikaze workers. You know, none of that happened. These people were fine when it was at its worst.
Similar, and the US grocery workers, 4 million of them, similar, and the UK grocery workers. So you can kind of work it out from basic logic that lockdown is not really having any impact. I put this together in May, and you can freeze the screen if you want, but the evidence, engineering standard, scientific standard, is overwhelmingly against hard lockdown having a substantial or useful benefit, and the costs are enormous, as everyone watching will know. Just another illustration of that point about lockdown, because I really feel that I have to hammer this point home. Here's the UK deaths registered in England and Wales, and we see overall death obviously increased due to SARS-CoV-2 in this short period. And we see SARS-CoV-2 or COVID. And we also have influenza and respiratory. Here's the lockdown point. Here's the lockdown release point where millions flooded to the south of England and packed it out. But for the next 4 months, nothing happened. And here's the mandatory masks, which came in mid-summer when the COVID problem had essentially disappeared seasonally, so mandatory masks came in. But note the blue lines, that respiratory and influenza never once even shimmered or slightly reacted to all of these measures.
So what he's pointing out, he's got a graph here where it's got the COVID increases, and you know, in comparison to, you know, he's got the lockdown, and he's got the lockdown release and the mandatory mask, taking us up to where we are now. And he's comparing that to flu in a blue line. And you can see in the graph in this blue line that it absolutely, it doesn't change at all. It doesn't spike. It doesn't go down. You know, when we had a lockdown, you'd expect that maybe to sort of go to really, really drop down. And then when their lockdown release, because don't forget, that's a virus too. This is flu he's talking about. It doesn't react to anything. In other words, these lockdowns, these masks and everything else, the conclusion is that they don't do anything whatsoever.
Right. So keep that in mind. The little bump in flu here is just misattributing due to COVID. So COVID followed its path, which was almost predetermined, independent, and the influenza and respiratory lack of change, any change, illustrates the point quite nicely. So what happened in the last couple of months in Ireland? Well, the case-demic hysteria occurred. So in the actual epidemic, we had a huge rise in cases. And then in recent months, we have another enormous rise in cases, but we're doing vastly more testing. So that's one of the reasons for this. And also, we've got false positives, etc., which we'll talk about in a moment. But let's look at the deaths during the actual epidemic versus the case-demic. In an actual epidemic, you have an impact with a new virus, right? It hits the susceptible and there's some immune naivety in the population and you get an impact, sadly. But let's look now at since the epidemic was over, it's over around May 2020, let's look at the deaths. And as you can see, they're vanishingly small. Nowhere within a mile of epidemic level. The impacts don't rise in a case-demic. They may rise a little, but nowhere near epidemic levels. You have low levels of sickness, ICU, mortality. So we've had 4 months now. We brought in mandatory masks here for whatever reason in the middle of the summer, but we've had 4 months of this. But we'll move on to talk about going forward. One very important article to read is about the PCR test, which causes case-demics. And this one from Professor Carl Hennigan of the Oxford Centre of Evidence-Based Medicine. Very good to look that up and read it. But I'll describe the basics. So again, we show Ireland and Sweden, a good compare. Back here in March, April, we had an epidemic, in fairness, with the new virus that came along, like a bad influenza. By the end of May or so, the epidemic was over because the impacts had fallen below what any sane person would call an epidemic level. But if you PCR test, like was being said to do by the authorities, what happens? Well, your cases go through the roof because it's endemic now, SARS-CoV-2, and you're going to see loads of cases if you do hyper-testing. And you get yourself a case-demic, as described. Let's look, though. Ireland is doing 10,000 PCRs a day, approximately now, which is astonishing. I believe 19,000 the other day. Let's say you get 100 positives. It's very scary. And they feed into your case-demic, for sure. But what if you were scientific and thought about what these cases mean? You'd realize that a huge amount would be false positives, because of the specificity of the test. That's a reality. A lot of them are going to be old fragments of ours because we know from the science that you could have this 4 or 5 weeks ago completely be.
And also, it's worth bearing in mind because it's a really important topic. When they bring out these figures, for example, in BBC News, where they're concerned, BBC News and other mainstream media propaganda outfits, when they talk about deaths for COVID, in small print along the bottom, it says within 28 days of a positive COVID test or testing positive for coronavirus, so that the death for any reason. Now, that's in small print. They are covering themselves, I suppose. But that's a huge point. That even the deaths themselves are probably not directly as a result of coronavirus. It's probably, if we give them the benefit of the doubt, it's coronavirus tipping very old people over the edge. But equally, because these cases, they show up old fragments. So if someone tested positive for COVID-19, it might have been they had the virus 3 months before that and had recovered from it, and they've still got a few fragments in them, which aren't going to be any harm to them or any harm to anybody else, but it still show up maybe in a test. Even that, if someone dies within 28 days of that, that goes down as a coronavirus death. So this is when you break it down, as I say, when you pull the curtain behind, like in the Wizard of Oz movie, there's nothing to see here. This is pure, deliberate hype job, propaganda, and it's amazing because what's scary is that even at the height of the epidemic, it wasn't that bad, really, in comparison, you know, to other years where we've had a lot of deaths from flu, for example. Yes, it was more, according, but again, their figures are so questionable. But even if we allowed for the figures that were, you know, presented at that point, it still wasn't even that big. But now they don't even have that. So they're just focusing on cases, which is why he's calling it a case-demic. And now it's even more pathetic. So that's what's scary. Because these guys are just hell-bent on keeping this thing going.
It and still have the viral fragments that the PCR test picks up on. Another bunch will be trivial positives. In other words, they will have fragments of virus, but they're not transmissible and they're not of any relevance to the situation. And a small number would be possibly concerning positives who are transmissible and are maybe symptomatic. So obviously this number should be ascertained and used to inform what's going on, because that's the really important number, and it's going to be very small relatively. But then you wouldn't really have a case-demic, would you? So why are they doing this? Why are they using, in many countries, this total number, which is kind of meaningless? With any shred of scientific thinking and attitude and management, they wouldn't use this. But anyway, they're using it. So let's look briefly at Sweden before we return to Ireland, and we look at their deaths per million over the past 5 years or so. And we see the deaths per million go from around 650 people in the summer up to 950 or so per million in the winter. And this is a pattern seen all over the world. So in 15 into January 16, you have a huge rise in mortality. 16 into 17 in Sweden, same. 17 to 18, same thing. And note that it's the red line is the mortality here. This yellow is just an average for multiple years, and the blue. So it's the red line. So let's look now at 18 into 19. Sweden had a very soft season. This is a huge difference in deaths per million, very low. And the first part of 2020, 19 into 20, was very low compared to usual. So you've got all these extra thousands of people now who would have passed, sadly, but didn't because of the influenza and other dynamics of the previous soft seasons. So what happens when a new virus comes along that's particularly hard on the aged? Well, it's going to really hit these people, sadly. So in April 2020, we see a significant corona-related spike. Now we look at what might be coming in the future. Let's take 18 as a sample year and let's project it across to see what could happen in 2021. Here we go. So Sweden could, in the coming 6 months, certainly see a big increase in mortality, but that would be pretty normal. And because SARS-CoV-2, coronavirus, rises in the winter and is more prevalent, you will actually find SARS-CoV-2 on many people aged who pass away, right? But that doesn't mean that COVID drove this coming season, right? The season may very well be similar to all the others in terms of actual impacts. So we've got to be really careful here and watch closely what happens. And I'm sure Sweden will take measures if SARS-CoV-2 COVID is driving major mortality. You know, but I think they'll be pretty careful to make sure that if it's not the case and it's a more normal winter, that they don't overshoot in their measures. So anyway, this could be a normal winter, just with SARS-CoV-2 also being found in PCR testing. Note that Sweden, for the last month or two, is almost back to normal. No masks here and people shopping and going to bars and cafes, and they're actually doing a version of that back during the epidemic. You'll see also in Sweden in the past weeks, people are here on buses, no masks, no particular distancing, right? Because they're managing the epidemic very well, according to the science at the moment. So let's go back to Ireland now, and let's look at 1718. And here in the dark line, you can see the rise in hospitalizations for all respiratory viruses as you come into the winter. And we're going to put in 8th of September, okay? We're going to put in the 8th of October, kind of around today. And you'll notice that there's a very big rise between the 8th of September and 8th of October in hospitalizations for respiratory. And going forward up to December for this year, though many are similar, you have another huge rise. So we can expect a huge rise in hospitalizations as normal. This is the normal nearly 10 times rise in respiratory admissions. Right? So we've got to be careful again not to consider things totally abnormal in the coming weeks. Now, Professor Philip Nolan the other day had a great tweet stream and he showed the latest data for hospitalizations. So I'm going to leverage this. Thanks, Philip. And we're going to compress it down to fit the time frame of the graph I showed you from 18. And we're going to put in the trend line. And certainly a concern that hospitalizations for people with SARS-CoV-2 in a PCR test are rising kind of exponentially. But let's put that in context, referencing back to real data from 18. Let's take the trend line and project it up to its place here. And as you can see, it pretty well matches the increase in general respiratory admissions from 18. So it may not be so special at all. I will say that I interviewed Professor Gordon Lutz the other day, and I'm going to release it shortly. And he has a fascinating paper out on humidity. And as we go into the winter, humidity indoors may very well be a very big factor in how many people suffer badly from this. So going into the winter, we should be thinking about the science. And the humidity, basically, when it's higher, increases people's mucosal immunity. So your mucous membranes that are the first line of immune defense against SARS-CoV-2 are enhanced very much with higher humidity. So this is something we could be doing rather than lockdowns going into the winter. And also, of course, we could be advising people to lower their insulin resistance, leptin resistance, easy to do. We could be advising people to increase their vitamin D status, which has been massively linked to poor outcomes from SARS-CoV-2. We could be doing lots of things that would really leave a mark, really help everyone in the winter. But unfortunately, we're only looking at lockdowns, which we know from the science do next to nothing, right? Except for destroy your society and delay cancer diagnosis and cause, you know, pain, suffering and destruction. They do that. But we know they don't teach for COVID. So that's a point to keep in mind. We do know what would help. And sadly, since March 2020, we're not really advising people on that. But anyway, we look now, we're coming to the end, at hospital admittance and discharge. I pulled this from the Irish database. And you can see in orange are people who are admitted with SARS-CoV-2 positive PCR. And in green each day, you see discharges. So right now, discharges are kind of trying to keep up with admittance. It's not too bad, but hospitalizations are certainly rising, as we showed in previous slides. But this gives a good perspective, I think. In ICU, again, ICU is rising more than people are discharged from ICU. So the ICU is rising, but again, we got to keep in the context of prior years and normal seasons in prior years. This 8 extra is just today. There's no discharge shown, but the overall ICU shows 6 increased. So I guess we need to wait and see where this goes. This data is pulled together by the Irish Times, and it gives another view just from September. They have it up to now. And you can see there are confirmed cases in ICU, but no exponential rise, more a long, steady rise. So you could choose when you want to do restrictive measures. Doesn't look like there's any panic, but they've done restrictive measures all back here. when it's been pretty flat. And you've got confirmed cases on vent has actually increased, right? So that's probably a useful metric. It may relate more to actual COVID, but we really don't know. We don't have breakdowns of this data. Keep in mind what I showed you earlier, right? That just 5% approximately of people who died in the actual epidemic had been admitted to intensive care. So there could be the case too that with way less pressure on the system now, people are being admitted where they wouldn't have been back here. We don't know that. So that's a point. ICU admission criteria are subjective, so we got to be careful with this data. Another thing brought to my attention by somebody on the inside is there's a suspicion that high dependency units, which is like ICU light, you know, people who are put into those units on maybe oxygen, may be included in ICU figures. But I don't know if that's the case.
The other thing that they're very slow in informing you of is that people who are being hospitalized, which are low in numbers, they're very quick to be seen, checked out, and released from hospital again. Because in the early stages, they've become more effective at the whole process of dealing with coronavirus and knowing what to look for, getting everybody in quicker, and have been more organized as a result of earlier in the year and since. And they're not really telling us that, you know, it's a scaremongering propaganda, these one-liners devoid of any context about how many cases, the percentage increase. You know, they love to do that, you know. Oh, there's a 46% increase in hospitalizations. Sounds like a lot, but, you know, what's 46? You know, you go from, what, 10 people to 14 people? That, I think that's about 46%, more or less. It doesn't sound so scary then. But another thing that, as I say, they're doing is they're not telling you that a lot of people, the turnaround is very quick. They're getting people in, they're getting people out. And the other thing they're not doing is we have a lot of drugs. I think Ivor Cummins here mentioned there's drugs come on the market now which are helping to suppress the symptoms of the virus. Donald Trump has obviously been promoting those drugs after his own coronavirus infection. Anyway, folks, listen, I'll leave it there. This guy's called Ivor Cummins, and this video I was looking at, if you go on his YouTube, this one's called Ireland and Europe's Viral Outlook. What does the latest data say? It says that the whole thing is pretty much a hoax. I'll leave it there. I'll be back again next Wednesday. That's Wednesday the 21st, I believe. Same time, 8 p.m. UK in London here where I am. 2 till 3 Central Time and 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I will wish you well. Until then, stay safe. And as like he said, I've started to take some extra vitamin D. None of us are saying this thing has no threat, but we can work it out ourselves. We can wash our hands. We can be careful when we need to be. We don't need to be wearing masks, which have no proof that there's any evidence for it. We can just eat well, get our immune system strong, which we should be doing anyway. Sleep well, get some exercise, get some fresh air. You know, if we need to, take some extra vitamin C, take some extra vitamin D, whatever. We have immune systems that God built into us. Anyway, until then, folks, God bless you. And I will give way to, I think, Graham Sutherland. Is Graham coming on tonight? I think he probably is. So hopefully Graham's well, and he's coming on to join us here tonight. That's from 9 till 10 p.m. here in the UK. Until then, folks, good night. God bless.